everybody. I'm Elizabeth Alfano, and we are live today, sort of. In the house with me, I have Billy Corgan of Smashing Pumpkins and Chloe Mendel. And Chloe, you're going to talk all about the Maison Atia. Am I pronouncing this right?
Yep, Maison Atia.
Ooh, I love it. Hear that French accent coming from her. Maison Atia. We were meant to be on Nightside tonight, but we're doing a little shifty shift. So this is going to first start on Facebook and the website, and then from there we're going to go live, hopefully, on Nightside sometime in January, folks. So great to have you with me tonight, and thank you guys for braving the cold and coming down to WGN.
It's very cold here in December and January.
Yes, both months we can count on it.
Yep, I'm ready to go.
Already. Well, you guys do a lot of that, actually. I think you live in New York and Chicago.
We call it tri-coastal.
Okay, so you're at Los Angeles as well?
Yeah, Chloe was born in Los Angeles, and I obviously spend a lot of time out there because of the whatever's left to the music business. So,
yep, I just like it there. So I just go whenever he's there to take advantage of the warmth of weather.
And where do you guys stay? Not necessarily the hotel or whatever, but what part of town are you in?
It changes. We used to have a home in Beverly Hills, but that's gone now.
Oh.
And now we kind of go from hotel to hotel.
Yeah, mostly in the Hollywood area, just because that's where most of our friends are.
I like the Bel Air Hotel.
You know, I'm still a fan of the Sunset Marquee.
Yeah, it works for me.
I love the Sunset Marquee.
He likes it.
Okay, well, let's get down into it, people. So, lots to talk about because, of course, Billy is just about to head out to tour. I think that was announced that you're going to head over to Europe. But before we get to your schedule, Billy, I want to talk to you, Chloe, about Maison Atia and what it is, why you started it, and how you got here.
Well, I'm the sixth generation furrier in my family. I come from a lineage of Jewish Russian furriers. And my father took the family brand and expanded it into ready-to-wear and brought it to be, I guess, one of the top luxury brands in the world right now. And in my time in working with my father, learning the trade with my family, I felt like there was a calling out there for fake fur done with traditional craftsmanship and knowledge, and no one was really doing it that way. So I felt like I could bring the knowledge of a furrier into the world of fake fur so that people could have another option that didn't exist.
I didn't realize that you came from a line of furriers.
Yeah.
What a frightening industry. I'm sorry to say that. I'm just telling it like it is. What a frightening industry. Wow. And how do they feel about you going into fake fur?
Well, you know,
faux fur.
It's the way it started for my family was it was out of necessity. You know, you're in Russia. It's cold. The Tsar needs a coat. And, you know, they pay the Jewish peddler to do something. So I don't think it's like a choice of I believe in fur, I'm going for this. It was just what happened and how it grew inside the family. And then my dad brought it to a new platform and really branched out into gowns and red carpet. So for me, it wasn't so much going against it. It was more how do I take this knowledge and wealth and, you know, art that I know so well and bring it to a place that I would want to buy or felt accessible to me and to my friends and women who appreciate luxury. So
yeah, I mean, from my perspective as a partner in this, not in the business, but as Chloe's partner, I think what's really cool is that as social consciousness has evolved, and here we are in Chicago, you know, the home of the Stockyards. You know, we all remember how the Upton Sinclair book changed the meat packing industry. I think there's been a similar revolution in terms of how people view fur and how the barbarous practices and the way that fur has often been collected. So the good part about that is there's been an evolution in terms of consciousness about animals and how they're used or not used. You know, that's obviously a long and ranging debate. But in terms of, and this is obviously a little bit more of a shallow point, but it's the point we're making, is particularly women, you don't see fur in fashion as much anymore. Right. And yet, you know, you had a lot of beautiful styles. When we think of, you know, glamorous Hollywood, often think of like, you know, Joan Crawford in a fur or something like that. So I think what's really cool is the ability to bring back fur as a fashion statement and something that really accessorizes the way somebody looks without having the downside of the what is obviously a raised social consciousness issue. And I think Chloe saw a sort of a space there that nobody had stepped into.
Well, and I think that's absolutely right, because when I go to your website, and I'm not even touching the items, I see really high-end craft style. And every time I'm in a store and I consider faux fur, I say, it looks kind of cheap. Like, it just doesn't feel that luxury.
It, to me, fake fur was, you know, in my mind, no pun intended, was Courtney Love. It was grunge. It was, you know, it's what you get at a thrift store, and it's dirty and it's cool and you are on the road. There was never really a high-end element to it, and it could be. It's a fabric like anything else. I mean, you can buy a $2,000 t-shirt, so why is that t-shirt better than, you know, the Hanes t-shirt on the street? So to me, it was, how do we elevate this? And there are people who want this too. I'm not the only one.
Yeah, one interesting point I can jump in is from hearing about it from her, is the textile industry sees the growth of faux fur, and so they really want in on manufacturing really high quality textiles that will pass, you know, with the look of fur, and will have the fashion sort of aspect of fur, and also sort of innovate in the space. And this is all new. This is all basically in the last few years.
The eBay trend report just came out. Fake fur was the number one fashion item searched and purchased.
Oh, I love that.
It went up by
like 1,000% or something.
A couple 100% or something. So it went up significantly.
This doesn't surprise me, because I think it's a lot like vegan food. People see that there's a market niche, and that there's an empty spot, and that there's a way to make a lot of money here.
Can you imagine, sorry to interrupt you, but can you imagine 20 years ago fast food, vegan food?
Yeah,
it's unthinkable, right?
Yeah,
and now
impossible.
there's franchises that are coming that are basically, you know, the McDonald's equivalent of vegan food.
Completely. Beyond Meat, they're saying, is going to have an IPO soon. So, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so for us, there was never a fake fur company that was looked at through the eyes of a furrier, which I think is what separates us from everyone else. I mean, as someone who knows fur, I can't expect someone who isn't in the world of fur and the trade of fur to know what a good quality or healthy, quote unquote, skin would look like, right? So that's where I come in, and I can, basically look at the materials and evaluate what seems like an expensive fur, what color looks right, what hand feel is correct, and kind of bring up that, I guess, classiness of it, which didn't exist before. And, you know, you can't know unless you're in it.
Yeah, it's wonderful that you have that family history and that you can bring that to the table. And when I went to your website, I saw so many classic styles. So again, you mentioned Joan Crawford. So really sort of 1950s styles that my mother would have worn, really lovely items. But I also saw a little bit of Jimi Hendrix in there. I saw that it could go a little edgy.
I mean, the brand is targeted for people like me, you know. I'm not in one box, and I feel like most people aren't. They want a coat that they can put on and wear to dinner, but also wear to work, and, you know, it's versatile, it's easy, and it's feminine. So we have that coat for everyone. But at the same time, you know, I like to wear more crazier things, and that's there too. But it's not in a way that feels offensive or really one time. It's kind of timeless fashion, in my opinion.
Are you going to wear anything, Billy, on stage?
Currently, Maison Achi doesn't make coats for me. we've had this discussion, but at this point, it would have to be a custom job.
And you don't want to, Chloe?
Oh, it's not.
It's I'm not taking it defensively, but I mean, when you're a small startup, you know, your margins are everything, and so everything is production line. So,
I mean, we don't make coats for men, so. He'll be the first man we'll make a coat for before my business partner, Gustav. I'm sorry, Gustav, if you hear this. But, you know, Billy is a better investment in my opinion.
Okay, so Billy's on hold until we start making coats for men.
I get to see, you know, the behind the scenes. The coats are gorgeous, and trust me, I would love to have them.
All right. Okay. Noted, everybody. Billy's getting a fur coat at some point, a faux fur coat at some point. Just some functionality questions here. We are in Chicago. It will be cold for a very long time.
Forever, I think, was the last forecast.
I think, yes, basically, until the planet collapses, which is, you know, we got about 12 years there. Do they keep you warm, faux fur?
Yeah, they do. You know, it's like fleece. It's the same material. You're warm in it.
Huh. Okay. Great. Well, good. Okay, so let me ask you this. Your styles go hand in hand with the price range. And so it is a pricier item, let's say $1,500 to $2,200. Is that about right? Depending on the coat size and length, et cetera.
Yeah, I would say they start at $900 and they go up. Our highest price point right now is $2,300.
Okay. So is that a sticky point or is that still very accessible, considered to be accessible in the haute couture world?
It's a mix of things. You know, for us, we make things with the top craftsmen. We're using real fur factories, we're using people who make fur coats. So to make a fur coat, you know, the starting price is like $10,000 and up for a luxury fur. So we're working with these people who know how to craft the best quality coats in the market. So it's not cheap to do. There's a lot of attention to detail. A lot of our coats are reversible, so it's two coats in one, and both sides are finished just as well. So it's not like one side is sacrificed for the other. Both, you can wear both sides of your coat, and it's, you know, meant to be worn on like that. So I think when you're talking about luxury and small production, it has to be at a higher price point, to be fair. I would love to make things at a lower price point, but you can never get that level of detail in a cheap production. And then you'd have to go to mass, like China, and we're not ready for that, nor do I think that's where we need to be.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of people really want to be in that price point. A lot of people actually, this is going to sound strange, but they don't want it to be $200 or
less. Yeah, there is a weird kind of reverse psychology thing sometimes when you you offer something for cheap and you think, well, by giving a good deal, you're going to create a sort of an audience. It doesn't necessarily work. We once did an experiment because we felt our t-shirt prices were too high with the pumpkins. So we did, I think we did about 10 shows where the t-shirts were priced at $25 and 10 shows were the price at $20. We actually sold more when they were at $25.
I think that's right. I think there's a lot to that, actually.
We don't really have much choice. There, you know, it's, when you're making,
you shouldn't have to justify. I think the root of the question is sort of the affordability versus what you get in exchange. And I think your point is the right point. It's the craftsmanship is really where the money goes.
Yeah, and we're making coats that are meant to last. Mm-hmm. I am not a fan of throwaway fashion, disposable things that don't last more than a year, 6 months. It's still a foreign subject to me because I don't buy things just to wear once and then throw out. But I know this is a majority of everyone right now. So for me, I make coats that I'm going to keep, that I plan on keeping forever, that I plan on fixing when they break, and I plan on sharing with my daughter, my sister, whoever. And that's the way I look at clothes for myself in my closet. So in terms of looking at fashion and that investment into a coat, in the long run, it's not that crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you're going to have it for a decade is what you're thinking. And you'll pass it on.
Yeah. I mean, I have clothing from my mother that I love. My grandmother is still alive, but she plans on giving me a bunch of her clothes. So that's how I see fashion, like beautiful fashion. You think of it as keeping it for yourself and sharing it with your loved ones.
So I have to ask you, because when I was looking at the website, I thought, okay, I'm going to get myself one of these coats. And I was a little afraid because they look so authentic and they're so well made. And I'm an animal lover and never in a gazillion years would I be caught wearing fur.
Sure.
I thought, people are going to think I'm wearing fur.
Yeah.
So I was a little bit kind of torn.
Wouldn't that be the greatest compliment to have somebody say something? You say, believe it or not, it's actually fun.
Well, that's what I thought. Then where would the discussion go from there? You know, if you can have
a positive one, because
hopefully.
I think you would spin it to why you're wearing faux fur. See, this is what I'm saying is, I think the ultimate translation point here, and look, who are some of the big brands that have basically declared they're not going to do fur anymore?
Well, it's Gucci, Michael Kors.
Everybody, yeah.
Okay, right.
Ralph Lauren is one of the first. So
obviously, this is a movement, right? But again,
I've been on those fur protests.
Well, right. And you know, look, I've done work with PETA in the past. We're obviously heavily involved with PAWS. I mean, animal rights is something that's really, really important to us as a family. But look, here's the real, you know, and again, it's a bit of a shallow point, but we're talking about fashion here, and fashion is meant to be kind of fun. The great thing here is we can bring the look of fashion back without the downside of sort of wondering, you know, what had to happen to put this pelt around us. And I think once the language of fur is put back into the fashion lexicon, and nobody will even question anymore whether or not it's authentic or not, because generally the culture will just say we're not going to accept it anymore. And that's not to put anybody out of business, but, you know, it's obviously sort of an outmoded modus operandi, at least in my opinion.
I think now people need to make educated decisions based on what they know and learn, and people want to learn and want to be progressive and want to put their dollars where it counts. This is something that millennials have shown are important to them. Whether or not they pay attention to where the dollar actually goes in the end, like what percentage goes to charity, is questionable, but they want to know that what they're buying gives back to someone else. This is something that it's a movement.
And let's remember, a lot of socially conscious millennials, and I've met a lot of them because they've taken me to task about this thing. You know, they're also holding an iPhone when they say these things. They're
sure.
willing to overlook. Yeah. They're willing to overlook some of the abuses in the technological world.
Okay, but there's a movement that people want to have conscious buying.
No, I'm not disagreeing. I'm just saying is we have to have a balanced argument about what matters. And a lot of times when people are making arguments, they're standing there holding a phone, which was made in a factory in a third world country where the people aren't paid a fair wage.
I do think, and I don't want to just whitewash over this, but it's a general statement and kind of does apply to everything. When you know better, you do better.
Sure.
Not everyone.
Didn't Maya Angelou say that?
Probably. I got it from Oprah, so then it must have been from Maya. when you know better, you do better. And so because I'm so deep into the animal world, I know about all the atrocities in fur and meat, etc. I don't really know about the ones in factories, except that I'm sure they exist just as they did, not just for technology, but for running
anybody,
shoes,
just
and
even like when you hear me say something like that, I mean, you know, Google away.
Yes, Google.com is your friend.
So my point is PETA has been very effective, and rightfully so, at raising a lot of alarms about what has gone on in the animal world in terms of abuses. I mean, I remember my generation was probably the first generation that started seeing, you know, these horrible things of baby seals and so, you know what I mean? And I mean, growing up in Glendale Heights, Illinois, I didn't know that went on, you know what I mean? And then now being a vegan, of course, you know, I'm happy to be out of an industry that, you know, doesn't always sort of, you know, raise and or, you know, whatever word you want to use for the way people procure meat. So again, these are really, really nuanced and deep arguments. And I think Chloe's point is right. Everybody has to make decisions. And that's all I think she can do is sort of inform people about her perspective.
I think by isolating people, it doesn't help.
Agreed.
So a lot of people, when I started Maison Atia, a lot of people asked, well, aren't you against fur? Are you vegan? All these things. And I would be like, I'm not against it. I think people have to make decisions and move towards what they feel is right. I'm not putting my energy towards making fur coats. I'm putting my energy towards being progressive and making faux fur coats that speak to me, because that's what I know I can do well. So I think step by step, people will go in the right direction. But by putting people in a position to take a moral stand on something they're not prepared to do, makes enemies, and that's not going to help either industry or any industry, really.
I do agree with that. People really do have to come to it in their own time frame, and the more discussions people have, the more you talk about it, like we're doing right now in WGN Radio, the more people think, okay, I'm going to Google that because I heard Billy Corgan talking about it. The more people start to come to terms with it, they learn more, and then they make different decisions for themselves if they choose to do it. But at least they have information, and that all starts with a dialogue, which is why I wanted to have you guys. Okay, so speaking of dialogue, I know that Billy's about to head to Europe for a European tour. Almost all of the cities that you are going to have banned fur. Everything except Italy.
Oh, really? Oh, that's interesting.
Every country except Italy and Portugal, but every other country on your European list has banned fur. And then we were talking before we started this interview, San Francisco has banned it, West Hollywood, which is oddly its own city, and then Los Angeles has banned it. Do you guys think we're going to ban fur in Chicago?
No. I don't.
In a way, Chicago has a very funny progressive side, though.
It does, but Chicago still has a lot of old money. It's got a lot of old people and cold weather. I don't think it's going to end it anytime soon.
You really don't? Oh, I was really hoping you'd say something else. I know we have some fox farms in Illinois that are just... we have fox farms here.
I mean, although Chicago's progressive, it's not as progressive as L.A., and it's cold. L.A. is hot, so they can afford to not support it. I think, you know, Chicago is still a very traditional city in some sense, and there's that generation that's still there that has their fur coats for the last 30 years and aren't looking to change anything.
But having a fur coat and buying a new one are two different things.
True, but it has to be in fashion for you to wear it.
Mm-hmm.
So if people see other people wearing it, they're going to want to wear it, mm-hmm. too. In Los Angeles, you're not really wearing a fur coat. So to buy it doesn't really make sense.
I mean, as a general comment, you know, faux or not, you don't see a lot of people wearing fur anymore. I just
Amen.
Don't. I don't see it like I used to. That's
right,
for sure.
Right.
I mean,
right,
I remember a time in 1975 when, particularly around Christmas holidays, you'd see a lot of women would pull out their, you know, the family fur.
Right.
And you know, I remember going in the bedroom at, you know, during Christmas, and there'd be like 8-9 furs on the bed stacked
at
a mile
party.
High. So.
Right.
Obviously, it's been erased in general culture. And so the question would be, you know, is the faux fur industry going to sort of fill a gap that's been created by the absence of something? Is it erased because, like you said, maybe people are uncomfortable? Do people have to be educated to then make better choices? And then does at some point, it's one thing to ban something, but a lot of times where industries have a lot of strength in a particular area, as we've seen with, you know, the car industry in Detroit or something, is there a way that the government can step in and offer sort of a transitional sort of thing that maybe takes people from one industry to another so mm-hmm. you don't put a bunch of people out of work, you know? Mm-hmm. There's lots of factors that go into those decision-making. Because like she said, you know, if you just make enemies outright, people are just going to dig in their heels.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's no longer it's not a moral and ethical argument, strictly a economic argument in their eyes. And when people get to that place, then it doesn't matter what you say.
Yeah, they tend not to budge. But I will say on the flip side, the Animal Legal Defense Fund says that Illinois is the top-rated state for animal laws and that Illinois is the most progressive in animal.
Well, look at PAWS.
It's great.
Well, PAWS is wonderful for sure, but also, you know, Illinois was the first state to say that elephants couldn't be used in entertainment anymore. These sorts of things, very progressive on dog fighting, obviously, laws against dog fighting. Obviously, we still have that. But so yeah, Chicago shocks me. Sometimes you never know.
Well, I know that shocks me too.
Well, I don't know. It doesn't shock me because I mean, we have particular love of our pets in the city for some reason. I don't know why we're different, but I know pets. You know, pets in families is a very, very big issue. I mean, if you just look at the response to what PAWS has done in terms of, you know, their charity, and they obviously rely on a lot of contributions. There's a lot of heavy hitters that come in,
yes.
And they're all obviously animal people.
Yes, yes. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about family and animals. So. I never thought I'd be saying Billy Corgan, the family man.
No, me neither.
Wow. Okay, so I think of you having two families. What was it like? I have to ask the question.
Dysfunctional one and dysfunctional two.
Well, maybe I'll give you three dysfunctional families then. Okay, so I know you sort of had a tricky childhood. Believe it or not, in 2015, you and I had an interview. We talked a long time about that at your tea house. But putting that family aside, you, of course, have the Smashing Pumpkins family. What was it like to be back together with your family?
Pretty... honestly, not that big a deal. It was kind of like you just get everybody back in the room and you just kind of go back to doing what you're doing and you start cracking the same jokes and
it's amazing.
Like no time has passed. Yeah.
You get back together with your high school friends and it's like nothing has happened.
Yeah, when you put James, Jimmy, and I in the same room for the first time in about 17 years, it was like no time had passed. It was shockingly uneventful.
Did it have that warm, fuzzy feeling?
It did from the standpoint of the longevity of the thing. That you could still have something to share 30 plus years later. That's pretty wild.
You mean that you could still feel connected?
You know, if you get in a time machine and you could go back to the Northwest Side where the band started in my dad's bedroom and just see, you know, James with his funny new wave haircut and me with my long curly locks, which I now get to look at on my son's head. You know, I don't think you could have made us believe not only what was going to happen, the crazy good stuff, but also the bad stuff, you know, the years of not talking. I think we would have had a hard time wrapping our heads around, wait, what we're doing here will one day matter, and it will matter to the point where we'll have a squabble over it that will last this long, and then ultimately be able to reconcile that and bring it back together. More so probably than anything. I mean, certainly we've wanted to repair the family rift for a long time, but the fans had a lot to do with us the fans had a lot to do with us continually having to reexamine why aren't we in the same room.
Mm.
You know, if the fans weren't there to say, why can't this happen, I don't think we would necessarily press for it, because like a lot of things like that, it's difficult to sort of have to reconcile or forgive or move on from something that's, you know, aggrieved you. I mean, we all go through that in family situations. And, you know, if you're not forced to sit next to Uncle Lou at Christmas, you know, maybe you just don't even bother getting into the issue.
Right, right.
And so the fans kind of forced us to finally sort of address it in a way that made sense. And like I said, once we did, once we sort of crossed that threshold, it's been remarkably uneventful. And we just have gone back to the business of making music, which is the best part of it.
Well, and I also think age has something to do with it. So there aren't that many benefits
timeless
to getting
at this point.
Older,
there's no age.
But you know,
we're like a good faux fur. We're just going to last forever.
And he segues us back to faux fur.
That's pro radio right there.
Okay, but now what's it like to also come back from tour and be at home with a baby? I never would have seen this.
Two babies. We got
two cats and
two dogs, two cats, and two children.
Wait, you have two dogs and two cats
and two children. Yeah. Yeah, we have two rescue cats from Paws.
That I know.
We have two sisters. They're not adoptees, but I was sort of handed them by a psychic somewhere.
We're talking about our dogs right now.
Arizona. Yeah, in Sedona.
Oh, a mystic in Sedona gave you two dogs.
Yeah, a mystic gave me the two dogs, and then the children sort of just arrived.
Accidentally. No help from you.
I don't know. I don't want to. It's WGN radio. It's a different.
Okay. Now, I know Augustus is 2.5. Is that right?
He just turned 3 last
week. Oh, my word. So you have a 3-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And then I didn't realize that you had another baby.
Yeah, I have an 8-week-old.
You have an 8-week-old baby and you're here with me?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Promotion knows no bounds.
Yeah. Wait, so two dogs, two cats, and one really a baby.
Yeah.
Oh my word. Okay, so Chloe, back to you. How do you keep it all together?
I don't.
Okay, well, there you go.
Yeah, we were just fighting today how I don't.
So your manner of getting through it is just saying, like, I lower my expectations. It's not all going to stay together. So.
No, I don't lower my expectations. I'm realistic about me not being able to do everything I want to do, but I still want it all.
Yes.
So I just tell people that I'm juggling everything and it's going to come. I warn everyone who works for me, when I email you at 2 a.m., don't feel like you have to answer.
Okay, so now do you travel with both babies to New York? And
yep. My newborn, we just did one trip so far.
So we went
to New York, and I worked on the collection, and then I came back here, and I'm going back on Sunday.
Oh, my word. And do you travel together, or do you sort of say, okay, I'm doing music, you're doing
every
fashion?
Every configuration.
Okay, so it's
yeah, because like last summer, my son toured a lot with me, so, you know, like one of his uncles flew him out to wherever I was, and he would be with me on the bus and in my hotel room for 2 weeks, and I was dad during the day, and then at night he would watch, you know, 2 or 3 songs and then want to go back and play with his toys.
But you are so lucky to have that, to have it all work. So many people lose their families when they're wanting to be creative and they have to choose, and the two of you seem to be able to be both extremely creative and family knit. Is that right?
I think we think of it as it's all intertwined. Like the creativity is connected to the children.
To the babies.
Children are connected to the creativity. And we try to welcome the children. Obviously, the little one's very little, but she'll get the same treatment. We welcome the children into the creative space. When my son was, you know, 8 weeks old, I would sit with him at the piano and play the piano with him sitting on my lap to the point where he learned to bang on the piano himself. And now he'll just go up to the piano on his own and play, you know. And now it's more of a question of, please don't hit the piano so hard, Junior. But I think best way I could say it is we try to make our creative space not different from our normal life space. And so the children are very comfortable, I think.
Yeah, I mean, we work a lot from home and the kids are around us while we do that. So there's not really a border or a barrier between work, home, and life. I mean, we kind of work 24-hour cycles. There's like, it's a kind of a fluid lifestyle we have. There is no difference, and the kids are just a part of that. Mm-hmm. I have fond memories of growing up in my dad's atelier. You know, he had this tiny little space on Madison Avenue before he grew it into a big company, and I used to go there and play there after school because it was next to the school, and then he would let me make my own clothes or my own bags. So it was kind of just what we did. We kept busy by being a part of the whole workshop, I guess while waiting till Dad could come home for dinner. So that's kind of how I see my life. It's just they're a part of my extended workshop.
It's such a rich life, really. If you don't mind sort of the frazzled nature of it, I think it's a really wonderful life for the kids to have so much richness.
My father is a musician, and I grew up in that, and a lot of crazy people around me. So I felt I was enriched by knowing lots of people and having to learn how to navigate lots of different personalities in the space. And, you know, creative people are, you know, they tend to be all over the place, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. It is a good lesson for life because, you know, it at least set me up to realize that the world is rich, and personalities sort of drive the world. And, you know, then you go out in the real world and you realize a lot of people are sort of in their lane. You know, they dress the same, they talk the same, and, you know, you're looking at reality almost like, why are these people moving at a different speed than the world that I grew up in? And that helped me make really healthy choices as far as what I wanted to do with my life.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I always find that a sort of messy childhood is a good lesson for later on in life because life is messy. Like, life doesn't stay in its lane. Life is all over the map.
Absolutely not.
Yeah. So has being a parent for either of you enriched or detracted from your creativity? Does it make you sort of sleep deprived so it's harder to be creative? Or, I don't know, or maybe having kids has enriched your creativity?
I'm sleep deprived. But, you know, my life didn't really kick in until after I had kids. I had my son when I was 23. So I was a 23-year-old living in a mansion with Billy. Like, it wasn't like I had much responsibility going on. I was traveling and doing what I wanted. So I had a baby, and finally I was like, maybe I should take my life more seriously.
I love it.
I wasn't doing nothing. I was working with my dad in the studio. I worked on the couture collection in Paris, and so I was busy. But
I see what you mean. It does take a little while to get some focus for what you want to do.
I wasn't sure what I wanted to do long term because I knew it wasn't working in his company, in my dad's company, and it wasn't being Billy's manager.
Yeah, I can see where that would be stressful.
Which a lot of women kind of come in and co-manage their, you know, husbands. So I wasn't interested in running his life either. So in that, I thought, you know, the only time I'm going to start a company is now, or I might lose, you know,
the window.
Yeah, lose the window of opportunities. And I had great support around me. My business partner, who's amazing, he was there at the right time, and I asked him on his birthday, and it worked out. So it just all happened, and then moved on from there, and I have a company who is a year old now, and we're expanding. We're hiring people. We're excited. We're going to do a real Fashion Week presentation. So
when will that be? Which Fashion Week will be your first?
New York Fashion Week is February for fall winter, and that's really our season. So yeah, we're going to present then. I'm very excited. I've been working on this collection for the last 6 months, so I'm excited for it to be done.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I mean, it's impressive when you see, you know, Chloe's a young woman, but, you know, she's got a pen in one hand sketching, and she's got a baby on her breast nursing. I mean, that is the ultimate, you know, empowerment.
Yes,
I
would agree with that.
She has her own company. She's a great mom, and, you know, she's leading by example, and I think that's fantastic.
That's so awesome. So let me guys ask you, do influence each other? So maybe not just how do the babies influence you? And I'll say the kitties,
wasn't
the dogs,
part
and
of
the
what
babies.
Our argument but, was about to say.
Get out of my workspace.
Yeah.
Because if he's playing, will you ever say, Chloe, oh, I like that riff or stick with that one? And do you ever tell her, Billy, like, oh, no, not that coat line. That's not going to happen.
All right. I don't tell him what to do. I ask him to tell me what to do all the time.
Okay, so is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Are you asking me?
It's a free-for-all, people. Go ahead. We can finish the fight that you started before. We can finish it here.
I don't know.
Can I have $1 million in cash?
I'm not a big...
Could
exactly.
I also have $1 million in cash?
Sure. We can discuss after we get off the air. I'm particular to if people want to be involved in the creative process, it's more helpful if they're involved from the ground up. It's easy to have a lot of anybody that can hear what I'm saying. It's like there's a lot of armchair critics that don't always appreciate the process or where you are in the process. So I think I'll go to Chloe and ask her what she thinks, and she basically sort of doesn't offer opinion unless I'm asking, because she knows that I'm really sensitive to where I could be in a particular part of the process. On the other hand, she's very much a person who likes a lot of feedback, and I'm happy to give that feedback.
Well, then that seems like a healthy balance.
Yeah, I mean, it's called being indecisive.
Well, only, you know, I don't know. And I'm not
We're
an artist.
We're different personalities
like,
that
yes,
way, yeah.
Gosh, obviously you're different personalities, but also, and I'm not an artist, so I might have a different perspective, but Billy, you've been at this how many years now? How many decades? We're going to give you a two solid decades and
no,
obviously
no,
more.
Over three.
Three.
Yeah, so, I started as a professional when I was 18, and I started writing songs when I was 18, so I'm almost 52, so we can do them. There's some rough
right,
math
there's
in
some,
there.
Yeah, 30 plus 32, 3 years in there. So 4 years in there. So that's a long time. Now, if you're just starting, Chloe, and your business has been up and running for a year, and at the same time you have, you know, two babies, obviously you have a lot going on. So I would imagine 5 years from now you'll have a different perspective on your creative process, and 15 years from now you'll have a different perspective on your creative process. So it seems to me that that's a normal starting point of lots of questions.
As a sort of a just a general comment, I think a lot of young artists approach me either socially or you know, they'll DM me on Instagram or something, and they're, you know, they have that perspective, which is like how I felt at 18. You're looking up this vast mountain, and there's people standing on top of the mountain, and there's no trail up the mountain. You say, how do I get up there? And what you do realize with time and success is that synergizing the let's call it the branding part of your business, which is how does my business separate itself from other businesses? How do I stand alone in a very crowded market? And that's not just entertainment. That's any
that's
market.
Anything. And it's hard.
How do I synergize who I want to be with my actual talent, what I'm good at, and at the same time, how do I minimize the things I'm not good at in a way that won't hamper me? That's a hard set of factors to navigate for any young person. Because the young ego just wants to be appreciated for having talent. The marketplace doesn't care. The marketplace looks and said, there's tens of thousands of people are talented. It's up to you to differentiate why I, the person holding the check or the, you know, the keys to Valhalla, let you in these doors. And it's very hard for young artists, and it was hard for me as a young artist to understand. Chloe's in a different position in that she has me, who's been through this process of brand building and dealing with, you know, everything from media to, you know, even the ethical questions about the business. This all becomes part of it. I mean, I've been criticized ethically for tons of things. And then also her father, who is also coming from the fashion side. So she's lucky in that she has access to two people who've built their own businesses and sort of been through the ringer. Most people, unfortunately, don't have access to that. So I don't mind her asking questions, because I realize that's just information that you can only learn from experience.
Right. Yeah. It'll just take you time. But it's a natural starting point to be asking around for lots of impetus.
Well, no one wants to lose. That's the thing. And that's often what times gets in people's way. It's like you can only win by risking, and you will never win by not risking, in particularly in the arts.
And you'll never, quote unquote, win by not failing a gazillion times first.
Oh, no. I mean,
never. You'll never knock it out of the park the first time.
I mean, here's like funny math. Like, I've written probably 400 songs in my life, and maybe people know 10, 15 mm-hmm. songs that I've written. But in the math of the business that I'm in, that's actually
huge.
Really good
that's
math.
That's a great
number. That's really good math.
Yeah.
But I mean, to me, that feels like a whole lot of failure. You know, it feels like I'm hitting, you know, 120 at Wrigley Field on a sunny day.
For anybody listening, a young artist, that is just fantastic advice, I think, from beginning to end. I'll be sure to get that as a little clip for Instagram or something. That's, I think, really powerful. Well, okay, so you have different creative streaks, and obviously Chloe, you're in fashion, and Billy, you're in music, and sometimes you talk to each other about the process, but there's one area where you really do work together, and that's animals. Talk to me about your work for animals.
Well, Billy introduced me to Paw Chicago when I met him. We started going to the fur ball, and I met the community here, and it's been such a great experience. I knew that whenever I started a company, there had to be some sort of giving back, and giving back to a charity that was integral to me, that I was active with. And the only charity I've ever been active with is Paw Chicago, because I question the integrity of charities in every situation. I'm always wondering, does the money really go to where they say it is? And I know for a fact it does with Paws. I see it happening. I know the people involved, and they are just wonderful, good-hearted people, and they make the environment so pleasant. You walk into a shelter and you feel happy. You know these animals are taken care of. You know the people working there are happy and feel rewarded by their experience. So for me, there was no better place to put money, time, and energy than there, because I knew it was going to do good. And I think Billy feels the same way, which is why he's been involved with Paws, and the Fasayas family have welcomed us in. And, you know, it's really been a great experience for me in Chicago, because Chicago is not my hometown. I know very little about Chicago. I do not care about sports.
You're at the wrong station, my
people
dear.
People don't really like me. I watched the Bulls play the Knicks, and I sat in orange and blue on the floor seat, and no one liked me, and I don't even care about New York sports.
You should have stopped at your dog coming back to life. You've taken a heel turn here.
So Chicago is seeming a little foreign to you still at the moment, yeah. But Paws Chicago's been a nice entry
for you. Paws Chicago's
been
the best part of coming here besides Billy, so I'm happy for that, and the what we do is just so rewarding. Mm. And we have fun. They want to do cool events. Billy's donated a lot of his time into creating interactive artistic events, and they are all for it. And the people who are there come from all areas of life and are all passionate too. So
it's amazing the passion of the people who volunteer.
We've made friends with people just because of our interest in helping pets and owning pets.
You really feel like you're part of something with Paws. You feel like you're on the vanguard of where the shelter world is going.
Mm-hmm.
And quick story, the way I got involved with Paws in the beginning was I you know, like a lot of people, you start thinking, oh, I really want to get a cat. So I went to the Anti-Cruelty Society, and it was so, I was like, I get PTSD just thinking about my experience of going there. The way the animals were caged, the staff was really grumpy. It smelled terrible. You felt like if you didn't take home an animal, you were basically sentencing them to death. Mm-hmm. So the decision was like, this is a little bit too much pressure.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't much information provided on the animals, which obviously is critical in terms of making the right choice. And so I walked out of there thinking not only was I not going to go back, but I had already given up on the idea of getting a cat. Mm. And I'd mentioned to somebody else that I had been thinking about, or maybe I even related the bad story. And they said, oh, you should try this place over on Clybourne. It was Paws had just opened. I think they were less than a year open. I went in. I didn't connect with any of the cats that were there. But I talked to somebody that was there that was very nice. And they said, you know, I'm fostering some kittens at my house. They still got to get some surgery, but if you come over in a few weeks, I'd be happy to show them to you in my house. Went over, they couldn't have been nicer. I got my cats, Mr. Tom and Sammy, in 2003. And Paws made me sign a declaration that I wouldn't declaw the cats. They made me understand that there was a barbaric practice. I wouldn't have known that otherwise, because obviously you don't want your furniture torn up. And so I stuck to that, even though there's times I cursed the agreement. And then through that, I got to know over time, because they knew I had adopted the animals. They started inviting me to stuff, and I got to know about the charity itself, and I started participating and being friends with the Fasayas family. It's I can only concur with Chloe. It's been one of the most rewarding experiences I've ever had. I'm not going to name the charity, but I are charities. I can name some charities in Chicago that I and the Smashing Pumpkins, you know, gave a lot of time, a lot of energy to. And the minute we stopped giving money, we never heard from those charities again. We weren't part of the family,
mm-hmm.
and you felt like you were sort of used, mm-hmm. even though you were doing good.
Mm-hmm.
There was a really weird taste in your mouth. It's sort of like, was that real?
Mm-hmm.
What went on? Were those smiles real? Were those pats on the back real? Or were you just part of that year's fundraising?
Mm-hmm.
Paws is the complete opposite experience. Like, everybody involved really feels like family. And the level of participation, the amount of volunteers that are involved, the furballs, the way that they work with the city of Chicago to get the stray population down. I think the stray population in Chicago is 1/3 of what it was before PAW started.
Because of all their neuter programs, right?
Yeah, they have mobile vans that go into particularly lower income communities. And one of the greatest things I ever heard Paula say to me was, Paula Vasayas, the founder, she said, you know, just because people are in a different position in life doesn't mean they care any less about their animals.
Mm-hmm.
And it really hurts them that they're not able to spay and neuter their pets, because not only are they not able to control unwanted pregnancies, but they're also in a position of, like, what are they supposed to do with a bunch of animals that they can't care for?
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, the animals get turned loose, and the people are actually, they feel really bad about it, but they're not necessarily in a situation. So PAW is going into those communities and spaying and neutering the animals and really lowering the stray population. I mean, just imagine the amount of work that's done.
Mm-hmm.
The unnecessary euthanizing of animals because you can't find homes. PAW sets a high standard for adoption, so not just anybody can come in and grab an animal. And then they also have a policy that if for some reason the animal isn't working at home, you can bring back the animal, no questions asked. They monitor the family after the animal goes out the door. It's just a totally gold standard in terms of charity.
Mm-hmm.
And I've dealt with the biggest charities in the world.
I do love them. I mean, they're such a gold star on the city of Chicago. I think it says so much.
It's one of the best things
in the
nation.
Absolutely.
Yes,
right.
I'm so proud of being involved.
That's really what I wanted to say. So proud. But I'll also say that you've worked with other charities and so around animals. So, you know, PAWS really is about adopting basically cats and dogs only. But you've also worked with PETA and I think other animal rights organizations. Is that right?
Sea Shepherd is another one.
Oh, I love them.
Amazing.
Love them.
Amazing. What an incredible organization.
Yeah, boy, did they take it to the streets.
I'll give you just a quick story
if anybody's interested.
One of the most shocking things is there are international laws in the book that forbid whaling and killing of dolphins. And Sea Shepherd will send ships, all charitable, and, you know, all volunteer crews, young people mostly, will volunteer 3 months to go to the South Pole, literally, you know, you can imagine the conditions down there. 3 months on a ship, and there are people down there illegally whaling and harvesting, you know, dolphins, porpoises, stuff like that, and completely flaunting international law, and nobody will do anything about it.
And they really, like I was saying, take it to the streets. They go right down there, and they try to be blockades to these people.
And trust me, the governments are aware, and they will just turn a blind eye.
Right.
Particularly the Japanese government has been really, really difficult. They go into, well, this is what we've done traditionally, and they'll say, yeah, but it's international law. Well, you know, they kind of just shrug their shoulders. So really, really, really tough work.
What do you do with them? Or how you?
You know, I've donated and I've been involved. I'm on the sort of, they have a kind of an advisory board.
Uh-huh.
Because obviously, you know, when you're dealing with something like that, it's particularly international. The media part of it all and how to wage the information part of it all,
right?
To a public that by and large doesn't understand. You know, it's like if you tell the average person on the street, do you realize people are at the South Pole harvesting whales? They would say, wait, that still happens? That's something out of Moby Dick.
Or that anyone can even be on the South Pole.
Well,
I mean, I think South Pole information is strange, and
I don't mean this in any disrespectful way, but it's a much easier argument to make about a cow because a lot of people eat meat, or a dog and a cat because everybody has at some point in their life probably had a dog or cat in the home. Those are easier emotional bridges to make than a whale halfway across the world that doesn't have any... It doesn't have a defensive weapon. You know what I mean? It's literally a large, and you know, it's there. It is. It's you know, it's not hard to spot.
Right. Yes.
You know,
yes. Right. Yeah.
You know, it's by the way, it has to come up and get air.
Right. And don't they force them into small areas so they can't get out?
The coves where they'll slaughter the dolphins because they know that's where the dolphins are. I mean, it's just,
yes.
You want to talk about barbaric and horrific.
Luis Hoyos did a wonderful movie. Academy Award-winning movie called The Cove.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's been on my show, actually. Mm. Luis Hoyos is a wonderful director, Academy Award-winning director of the movie The Cove. So Sea Shepherd, they're a wonderful organization. And you are vegan, I believe, but Chloe's not vegan, right?
Or she's... We've traded places.
I was vegan when I met him.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
I turned her back to...
And you've gone, but
it's a carnivore.
So Chloe has stopped being vegan, but Billy is now vegan.
Yep.
Okay, and why? Both of you explain this to me.
Well, I was a vegan up until I was in the middle of my pregnancy with Augustus. I was a vegan just because I didn't feel like eating. Like, it wasn't a political stance for me. It was just, like, I didn't feel like it. But I didn't, like, announce I was a vegan. Like, it wasn't I didn't sit down at the table and say, I'm a vegan, I can't eat here. I just wouldn't say anything. But when I was pregnant, I forgot what it was, but one day I just felt like I wanted to eat meat, and I did eat some. I'm not a big meat eater. I'm still pretty much a vegetarian. And then I kind of don't really say I'm a vegan in general, but most of my food habits tend to be
that way.
So, yeah, I mean, it was just I started eating more meat when I was pregnant, and I've basically been pregnant for the last 3 years. So. It kind of happened that way. But Billy, I met him at a steakhouse.
Oh my gosh. Which one? Here in Chicago?
Yeah. At Joe Stone Crab, right?
Yeah, Joe Stone Crab, yeah. That's where he met.
But yeah, I met him and he was eating a steak bigger than me.
Oh my gosh.
I wasn't horrified that he was eating meat. I was horrified that the steak was bigger than me.
How much meat he was eating.
But I would generally eat like a 36-ounce steak.
Yeah, he could eat like a cow in a sitting.
Oh.
So it was...
Didn't you feel horrible? I mean, no. Physically, not mentally, physically.
No, well, there's lots of arguments there. As many people know, there's a lot of stuff going on in the meat industry that involves hormones and antibiotics. And even some people say that the way the animals are slaughtered... floods the
cortisol.
Meat with cortisol or whatever, so you're basically eating like a lot of fear. You know, that's obviously a bit of a spiritual point too. All I know is I reached a point where I started thinking about it, and the idea grew and grew, and it was a very personal decision. And a lot of times I'll sit down and, you know, have dinner with friends, and they'll, you know, I almost feel like they can't eat meat. And I'm like, I grew up in Chicago, you know, if you want to stay.
Seen it all.
It's for me, it's not a political issue. It's a personal issue. And for me, I just got to the point where I didn't want to be involved in that industry anymore.
Yes.
I didn't want to be part of, you know, what I would classify as a sort of a big killing machine. But I don't begrudge people who eat meat, and, you know, my family eats meat, and that's okay by me too. So, but me personally, I didn't want to be a part of it anymore.
So we're kind of back to the beginning of our conversation, which is
Fofur.
Fofur, but you know that a lot of millennials vote with their dollars, and I'll say the exact same thing. I'm vegan because I just don't want to be a part of that, and I'm certainly not going to contribute with my dollars. And when I watch television and I see like, okay, all Democrats hate Republicans, all Republicans hate Democrats, this is a complete mess, I feel sometimes disempowered. And then I go to the grocery store and I feel so empowered because I have my dollars and I put them where I want. And 3 times a day, I get to say, nah, I'm not going to be a part of it. No way, man, not me. And that feels great. So
yeah,
for me, it's just a wonderful feeling.
I look forward to a time, and I think it's soon, where consumers will have better choices about everything from their electronics to their clothes to the food that they eat, so that if a family decides, you know, for their own reasons, and again, I'm not casting any shade, okay, you know, we're going to eat, that at least they know they're getting, you know, the source, local producers, the food is not flooded with a bunch of stuff which harms your family. I look forward to a day when we all have better choices to make.
I think a lot of those people, when we have better choices to make, more information about better choices, a lot of those people will choose plants. I think they'll come a time when they'll say like, okay, maybe now I know what this is doing to my heart or my blood supply or my inflammation in my body, and they'll just choose.
And I'm saying this as somebody who's, you know, existed in the media world for 30 plus years. The problem is so much of our information is propagandized. It's hard to even know who to believe. Yeah. And I'll give you a perfect example. We grew up in a world where we were told from a very young age that drinking 8 glasses of water a day was really, really good to health.
Right.
And 5 years ago, out of nowhere, the government announced, no, it's not good to drink 8 glasses of water a day.
I never listened to them.
Well, but my point is
Right. No, it's very confusing.
If you just ask a person in terms of a logical thing, do you think it's a good idea to drink water? Most people would just on an intuitive level say, yeah, probably a good idea. Flushes out your system, keeps things moving, keeps joints lubricated. So for the governed amounts, oh, by the way, don't drink water. I mean, it's so counterintuitive to what, I mean, by the way, we're 75% water, you know, that's why people follow moon cycles because we're, you know, it changes the way our relationship to our body in terms of water. Complicated discussion.
It could go on.
You guys are quite optimistic. I don't think people are going to say no to Cheetos.
You're getting the real Chloe. This is the real Chloe.
And there's a lot of people who I know who are sick and you say, well, why don't you eat healthier? They're like,
huh?
Why? Like, I don't want to change. Life is good, you know, like
stay on the positive. You're doing well. listen, who's telling you to stay on the positive? It's like the ultimate misanthrope over here.
Oh, you two. I can see why you're a pair. How long have you been together now?
Six and a half years. We'll be 7 years next year.
Wow.
Seven years in the summer, yeah. Yeah.
It's a long time. Okay, so I have one more question.
It feels like an eternity.
That's going to be edited out, Chloe. Don't worry. That statement's not getting in. So one more question for Billy, and then I really want to hear about Chloe and all the exciting events that she has coming up, one right here in December. So one thing that I find disconcerting is that men get a lot of pressure that holding a cute cuddly cat or, you know, cuddling up on a puppy or caring about animals or just any sort of kindness in general, maybe even not animals, isn't the manly thing. And I wondered what you would say to that.
No, I just don't care about that. I mean, I think the ultimate testament to being a man in this world is being yourself and leading by example. I can't think of much that's given me more pride other than being a parent. Than helping save animals. It's one of the proudest things I've ever done, and in a million years I would never have questioned that. People would have questioned my motives in that or questioned my place in that, and I've been shocked in ways that I didn't think I could be shocked. But it's like someone said to me quite wise. They said, you know, work for God. And let man figure out the rest. So that's what I think we all need to do. We need to work for God, and make our parents proud, or however you want to rationalize all that. That's the way I look at it.
And is that the advice that you would give to men who feel pressured that they have to do the guy thing and maybe force meat in their face or be a bully to somebody or just kind of?
I don't know. I mean, I grew up in a very brutal world. A fairly safe world, although, you know, I did grow up in the time of John Wayne Gacy killing kids my age. And so I did live through that, and I do remember that. But it does seem like a simpler time. It was, you know, before the internet and all that. I don't know. I mean, I often find myself thinking about that my sensitivity in the world was what led me out of, you know, what was essentially a dead-end middle-class life. And how the brutishness of many of the people that I grew up around was something they couldn't sustain. That eventually life, if it was a fight, they lost to life. So they weren't able to access their greater inner creativity or their greater talents or their sensitivity in a way that they were able to provide for themselves and subsequently their families. So you can only win so many of those fights. There's always going to be sort of a bigger boss in the corner.
I'll also add to that, and I'll say real strength is someone who stands up for the vulnerable, somebody who stands up and says the right thing. A coward is somebody who just goes along with the bullies because that's what they feel that they should do because they don't want to stand out. They don't want to be noticed, and so they just go with the crowd. That's not a strong person at all, male or female.
I can't speak about a lot of other places, but certainly Chicago, the world that I grew up in, suffered from serious herd mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's done a disservice to our culture. There was a reason that our ancestors or our forefathers here or four people here built the Art Institute. They wanted Chicago to be the Paris of the West. You know, they were ashamed that we were just sort of a big stockyard. So the city has in its bones sort of an artistic leaning, and we're still getting there. We're sort of figuring out that our real strength in the 21st century is going to be, harvesting the true creativity and fighting spirit of the city. You know, it's to ultimately ascend past those brutal years. And so, I'd like to think I've been part of that, you know. But then I still meet people that, you know, they'd rather talk about the Bears, and that's fine. But, you know, life is a little bit more broad in the world than whether or not our quarterback's going to win the next game.
I love that Chicago has this incredible dichotomy. You can have the Stockyards, and it's an all-sports kind of city. And then at the same time, you can have some significant arts happening in this city. You know, you mentioned the Art Institute, but of course also our theater community and then our music community as well. And, you know, I spend some time in LA and I always think like, oh, this city is lacking the arts like I'm used to in Chicago. Mm-hmm. So it has this incredible dichotomy. Well, I know you have an event coming up on December 16th. Tell me all about that.
Yep. So we have I don't know what to call it yet. It's a pet friendly tea party at the Virgin Hotel. Santa will be there, and you can bring your pet for tea. I guess there you can have your pet at the tea table. They might have a little snack for your pet as well.
Oh, sweet.
It's a boozy tea party, so you'll probably be a little drunk, and you can take a picture with Santa drunk and your pet.
Okay.
And then
buy a
fake fur scarf, hat, something. We're going to have tote bags. It'll be fun.
You can see why they don't know what to call this yet.
Yeah, I think they were naming it today, but I think it's a Santa, pet-friendly Santa tea party, and I'm bringing our accessories there, so we're going to have great little gift items right before the holiday.
And can anyone go, or do you have to buy a ticket?
Nope. I mean, to go to the tea party, it's better to make reservation. It's on Sunday the 16th, but doors open for you to come shop, take a picture with Santa. You don't have to participate in the tea.
Okay, and there will be things that are gift-oriented as well for the holidays, or is it mostly your coat line?
No, I think I'm going to be focusing on the accessories because I think it's more fun and easier to buy for gifts. You know, we have great pull-through scarves. Those are our best sellers. We have hunting hats, like those big trapper hat things, and
I love
tote
those.
Bags. I'm really excited for tote bags. They haven't come out yet. They're actually being released that week for the holidays.
So. And are they faux leather or are they canvas?
Everything we make is animal friendly.
Oh, I love it. Thank you for doing that.
Every item's animal friendly. There's no dyeing or anything involved. And every coat purchased also provides a homeless pet transportation to a no-kill shelter through PAWS Chicago. So
you mean if they find an animal on the street or?
As in, you know, they do a lot of rescue work in other cities.
Mm-hmm.
So, when there was the hurricane flooding, I forgot where in Florida recently, they had to
North Carolina.
Bus a lot of animals back here in other cities as well. And also here, when they find animals on the street, they have to pay for the car to bring the pet to PAWS or partnered
affiliated
no-kill
shelter. Yeah.
So they kind of gave us the average cost, and we apply that cost to any coat purchased.
Okay. Yeah. And will there be information about this event on your website, or do we go to Virgin's website?
It will be on both websites. I don't know when.
Okay. When is
this is premature?
Okay. Okay. Well, what is your website address?
My website is www.maisonatia.com. MAISONATIA.com. And our Instagram has info, and I know Virgin will be posting it. Virgin Hotels will be posting it on all their socials, so it should be coming up soon, I think this week.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, I got to do a shout out to your Instagram page because just stunning. So everybody hit up the Maison Atia, MAISONATIA Instagram page because it's really a beautiful page. I love how you separate the coats like among nine squares. It's really well done.
Thank you. This was a long, long debate on is it going to be...
I know, it's stunning.
Is it going to work?
Oh, it's stunning. No, I think it's absolutely gorgeous. Okay, everybody, so you got your marching orders. December 16th, if you're in Chicago, you got to hit up the Virgin Hotel, Maison Atia, and bring your pet, and prepare to get boozy, apparently, on December 16th. And, of course, there'll be more Maison Atia events happening either in Chicago or New York or L.A., so you just want to get on her website for sure.
I got the name for the event.
What, are you going to be Santa?
No. No.
We're all coming now,
no, I'm
people.
An elf.
You're an elf.
You might find Billy the
Drunk
elf there.
Santa. Drunk Santa.
Drunk Santa and his chihuahua.
Christmas takes a turn, people. Okay, this is what I have down for Billy and the Smashing Pumpkins, and it's just going to sound so frenetic. The European tour, which is going to promote Shiny and Oh So Bright, Volume 1, No Paths, No Future, No Sun. If you're in L.A., you have to hit up my uncle, who owns Norman's Rare Guitars.
Oh, I know him.
Yeah.
That's your uncle?
That's what he said about you.
Oh, yeah. I know him very well.
Yeah, yes.
I bought tons of guitars from him through the years.
Yeah, he's a classic.
Oh, he's an institution.
He is an institution.
Now you get a family discount.
Okay, well, noted.
I'm definitely going to drop the name next time.
It's wonderful. Okay, and then you're also writing your own material, I think. That's what I read as well, that you're starting on Shiny and Oh So Bright Volume 2, and that you're also writing your own material.
Yeah, I have a second solo album coming out.
Oh, my gosh.
Which I haven't named yet publicly, but that'll coming out in February or March. And actually, one of the guitars that I use, I bought at your uncle's shop.
Woohoo!
It's actually called Drunk Chloe.
Okay, that's good.
No, the guitar? Or?
No. No, the album.
And we haven't been drinking here tonight, folks, just in case you were worried about us. Okay, well, I just have to say, with tours and albums and two cats and two dogs and two children.
Save the world.
And a new clothing business. Oh, that's right. And you're saving the world. Good luck to you, too.
Thank you.
I don't know how you're keeping it together, but thank you for all the work you do.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having us.